She was terribly upset when I mentioned possibly selling my home and moving here. I don't want to hurt her. You know I'm her only family. The silence hung between them, punctured by the hoot of an owl and the soft soughing of the wind through the cedars. At last Roy spoke, his voice firm.
I'd say that I could move to Buffalo to be with you, but I don't think that's the real issue. Kate's a grown woman with a life of her own. You've done a wonderful job of raising her, but it's time to let her go. Even if she doesn't want it, you need to push her out of the nest.
Roy's eyes were solemn as he took both of Sally's hands in his.
Don't throw away our chance at happiness. Say you'll marry me.
Sally swallowed, wishing the lump that had lodged in her throat would disappear.
I can't, she said.
The thought of leaving this wonderful place and never seeing Roy again made her want to weep.
Not yet, she added.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Travel Hour, followed by USA Today at 2.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 54 and clear. Tonight, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Greetings, folks. This is Monica Hatch with Mind's Eye Radio and the Travelogue program. And we will continue here with Travel and Leisure December-January issue. And it is the continuation of the destination of the year, the United Kingdom. And we pick up now with an article entitled Ripe for the Picking. On a weekend in Somerset, ex-Londoner Stephanie Cavagnaro finds a bucolic county forging a new creative and culinary identity. We're trying to create a taste of a specific place, explained Tom Calver, the cheesemaker at Westcombe Dairy. That place is the county of Somerset, where a patchwork of green pastures is stitched together by hedgerows thick with cow parsley and wildflowers. Ivy swallows up telephone poles, and herds of Friesian and Ayrshire dairy cows roam the hills as morning mists pool in valleys. 3 hours west of London by car, Somerset has recently become a bohemia for former city dwellers who have moved to towns like Bruton and Frome on the region's eastern fringes. This bountiful land was already recognized for its cheddar and West Country cider, and now a new young wave is building on that legacy with independent shops, boutique hotels, and restaurants with a hyper-local ethos. Calver showed me around his cheese cellar, which is carved into a cool hillside. Wooden shelves were stacked with around 5,000 rounds of cheddar. A robot nicknamed Tina the Turner busily flipped the boulder-like behemoths. In recent years, the Westcombe team has adopted an increasingly regenerative approach on its farm, having planted a complex seed mixture of grasses, legumes, and herbs. We're concentrating on the microbial diversity of the soil, Calver said, explaining how what the cows eat, quote, is reflected in the quality of the cheese, especially if you're not pasteurizing it. Beyond a chipped white barn door was the dairy shop, full of Westcombe's charcuterie and wheels of beech-smoked cheddar. I tried a slice of the traditional cloth-bound Somerset cheddar. It tasted nutty, caramel sweet, and slightly wild. The holistic approach to the land is shared by the Newt in Somerset, N-E-W-T, with doubles from 1150. It's a hotel on a 1,000-acre working estate that is deeply rooted in its Somerset heritage. The gardens and ancient woodlands are centered around the 17th century Headspin House, where the Newt opened its first hotel rooms, but new accommodations opened on the property in June 2021. On an electric buggy, I zoomed through acres of young orchards beneath a bruised blue sky to stay at the farmyard, which had once been a cluster of dairy farm buildings. One of them has been turned into the farmyard kitchen, a cavernous expanse of glass, wood, and stone. I darted in for dinner as rain pummeled the surrounding hillsides and cows sheltered beneath twisting oaks. A series of stunning tapas-style plates emerged from an open kitchen. Their ingredients came largely from the Newt's gardens. The food here is driven by the land, the estate's head chef, Alan Stewart, told me the following morning as we strolled through the produce garden. Neat rows of climbing French beans, brassicas, and summer squash sprouted between brick-lined ponds that harbored great crested newts. I try to encourage the chefs to come into the garden at least once a day, Stewart added. It's very much about cooking straight from the ground. Head cider maker Paul Ross is also helping establish the Newt as one of England's pioneering cider producers. On a tour of the press and cellar, which has towering stainless steel fermentation tanks, I learned that the estate grows 70 apple varieties, most of which are native to Somerset. One of them, the Dabinet, is used to make an oak barrel-aged single-varietal tipple that represents a robust departure from the usual blended styles. The Winston Sparkling Cider was also revelatory, a dry champagne-style cider with hints of crisp green apple, while the fine cider was light, aromatic, and wine-like. Next, I visited the honey-hued market town of Frome, F-R-O-M-E. Within its compact medieval center is steeped and cobblestoned Catherine Hill, a street flanked with shops selling rustic blooms, handmade women's wear, and Somerset sourdough. I slipped inside Ground, a ceramics studio and shop owned by artist Fee Underhill. Behind the cheery yellow facade, its window packed with dried tansies and joyful helichrysums, shelves displayed speckled gray mugs, pink pour-over sets, and cream-colored bowls. A long table was lined with sleek white plates, still dusty from last night's glazing. Bruton, Frome's spunkier cousin to the south, became a cultural powerhouse when Hauser and Wirth opened a gallery on Derslade Farm in 2014. Bruton's high street is small but mighty, with lifestyle shops championing British makers. A highlight is the Scandi Chic Caro, C-A-R-O, where the goods range from wild white sage smudge sticks to the shop's own line of chocolates, infused with pine, juniper, and other flavors of the countryside. Across the street is Number 1 Bruton, that's B-R-U-T-O-N, with doubles from 185. A boutique hotel that opened four new rooms in a medieval forge in May 2021. Mine was a summery stunner with exposed beams, pink-striped curtains, and patterned lampshades. Owner Claudia Wadhams, a Somerset native, called on her network of regional artisans to provide items like handmade goat milk soap and cheese, milk, honey, and cider for guests to enjoy in their rooms. The hotel's tiny restaurant, Osip, tasting menus from $79, was awarded a Michelin star in January 2021. "We're not exclusively vegetarian," the young chef, Merlin LeBron Johnson, told me, "but the idea is that what's coming out of the ground defines what we put on the menu." Osip's natural palette of stone and wood evokes the surrounding land, while most of the ingredients of my six-course lunch were sourced from it. Smoky yellow zucchini scrolls were stuffed with citrus and cold, creamy ricotta, while a delicate sheep milk pudding rested in a refreshing compote of white peach and elderflower. Most of what's served is grown on LeBron Johnson's farms, and he ambitiously aims to be self-sufficient with fruits, vegetables, and herbs by the end of 2023. "It's quite easy to control because I do actually grow everything myself, and I'm the chef, so there's that kind of synergy," he added. Garden Grown Fair also supplies his latest endeavor, the Old Pharmacy, which opened in an adjacent space in July 2021. This laid-back grocery, cafe, and wine bar sells provisions including Osip's raw honey, as well as small plates like roasted frigatelli peppers with smoked cod roe. A church bell rang as I strolled past stone cottages crawling with roses and field gates cloaked in thick brambles. I climbed a hill crowned by a lonely limestone dovecote. Cows grazed on the meadow that danced at its feet. Deep in the valley before me was Bruton, the golden town traced by the gentle river Brew. Rising in all directions beyond were pockets of copper beech and bold green hills, dolloped like mounds of sweet cream, a view you could almost taste. And then we have a little bit of advice here, Great British Bites. Cranachan, I don't know if I'm saying that right, C-R-A-N-A-C-H-A-N. Cranachan? What is it? A pudding of Scottish oats topped with raspberries, honey, whiskey, and cream. More traditionally, a Scottish-style cottage cheese called crowdie cheese is used instead of cream. Cranachan means churn in Scottish Gaelic. Where can I find it? Visit the Cranachan Cafe in central Glasgow, which touts the dessert as its signature dish. Usually eaten around the raspberry harvest in June, Cranachan is also served on January 25th as part of the Burns Night Supper, which celebrates the life and legacy of 18th century poet Robert Burns. And we have some great photographs here. Here's one of the old pharmacy, wine bar, and bistro, and it's just a small table, wooden table with wooden chairs. And above that, in some French, some English, mostly French, is the menu. And the prices listed there on a chalkboard. Here's Merlin LeBron Johnson out in the orchard there. And he's, looks like he's picking something. I'm not sure what this is, but it looks like apple trees behind him. Newer ones and older ones in front of him. He's got a basket on the ground and he's standing there looking down at his whatever he's picked. Here is a private courtyard of the number one Bruton Hotel. And it looks quite ancient. It's all made of fieldstone, the buildings surrounding. It looks to be, the courtyard is probably only, I want to say about 10 feet wide at one area and maybe 20 feet in the foreground. And then it's kind of rectangular shaped, but sort of triangular rectangular, I should say. But yeah, very old buildings, and the mullioned windows are painted a kind of an aqua color. Quite lovely. Here is a room, a guest room at number one Bruton, and we see the exposed rafters that are hand-hewn, so this must, and I can even see some of that fieldstone in the room itself, and the rafters resting on that. But the rest of the room is quite modern. There's a chest painted in a bright canary yellow, looks like a soaking tub that is painted green on the outside and then white on the interior of it, but it's right there in the room. And then the bed is draped in a quilt that's not terribly old-fashioned, not terribly modern either. Here is Caro, C-A-R-O, in Bruton. That's one of the boutiques place, and it's all painted white, as that room was at the Bruton. And very spare, as you might expect in a more modern shop. And the clothing hanging there in shades of peach and white and black. Here is Smiljan Radic. The architects designed this pavilion at the gallery Hauser and Worth in Somerset. So this is the gallery, and those were the architects, Smiljan Radic. And it looks like a giant propane tank. It's sort of shaped like that big rounded cylinder, and it's out in the country. It looks like the country. I just see some paths and grasses around, and that's all it is. And then there's something sticking out of the side of it. I can't see where the entrance is. I suspect it's behind these grasses that rise up in front of it. Here is a shot of Catherine Hill. That's that cobblestone street in the town of Frome, and it's a hill, all right. It would take some doing to to go up that in some high heels. It's all cobblestoned. But the buildings all, you know, sit side by side up against each other, each one with a different colored storefront, most of them in shades of green, I will say. Sage green, mint green, and then kind of an apple or grassy green. And there's a young woman standing in a lovely pair of bright jade shoes and then a colorful dress. It must be warm in the summer. It looks like a sundress and in a print of of kind of peach colors, and I think that's a dress shop behind her because I can see some clothing in the window. But all different rooftops. This reminds me of a little bit of Port Wayne, if you've ever watched Doc Martin, in the hilly towns and all the shops stacked up along the sides. Here is that ceramist that was mentioned, Fee Underhill. She's throwing a pot at her studio and shop in Frome, which is entitled Ground. And she's throwing a lovely little pot, and all around her are finished pots on shelves and hunks of clay waiting to be thrown and shaped. She's a young woman, I would say, you know, no more than 45, certainly, with brown hair, and she's wearing jeans and a short sleeve shirt, and she's leaning her wet hands into this spinning clay. And then we have a photograph of a beautiful piece of fish with lemon and herbs, and that's at the Farmyard Restaurant. Looks like it could be a trout. It's flat like that, but it's so beautifully browned. I think that's watercress on the table with it. Just luscious looking. And that was ripe for the picking. So let's continue with our destination of the year. And this one will be called Common Ground. That one, by the way, was by Stephanie Cavagnard. Common Ground. London is a city that's always on the move, and to help you take in the ever-changing landscape, we asked four locals where they're eating, drinking, and shopping in their favorite neighborhoods. This one's by Richard Godwin. And there's a photograph of Matthew Ball. He's a dancer. He's wearing a black turtleneck, and it's just a, you know, shot of his from the shoulders up. Handsome man with very beautiful blue eyes. About a 2-day growth on his face. He's a white man and has kind of a goldeny brown hair swished over to the side. And he's from Covent Garden. So he says, like all the young dancers at the Royal Ballet School, Matthew Ball, who enrolled at age 11, dreamed of making it to the main stage at the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden. The first time I walked in, I thought, this is where it happens, he says. Ball is now one of the company's most acclaimed male principals, celebrated for his performance in Meyerling, Kenneth MacMillan's classic ballet about a doomed Austro-Hungarian prince. Parentheses, Ball describes it as a bit like competing in a decathlon while doing Hamlet. But the magic of Covent Garden has not dimmed. I love the fact that at night there are about 20 sets of theater audiences in this one tiny area, all sitting down and hushing before the storm begins, he says. And there's a photograph of Matthew Ball leaping in action in Swan Lake. And you can see why he's one of the principal dancers. His form is beautiful. And even through the tights, you can see the muscles in his legs. Benjamin Pollock's Toy Shop. In this one, he says, historical theater land places are always so compelling to me. This one, which specializes in miniature paper theaters, is 100 years old. Benjamin Pollock's Toy Shop. Another favorite is Donmar, D-O-N-N-A-R, Warehouse, a small theater in Covent Garden. This playhouse is a nice contrast to what I'm used to. It's small, but that's why so many big stars like to work there. The last thing I saw was Henry V with Kit Harington. There are certain Shakespeare plays etched into your brain from school, but others you see for the first time, and it's like a smack in the face, which is a good thing for theater. DonmarHouse.com. .com? Yes. And then Nell of Old Dury. This is a pub, and we have a photograph of a woman painted on the shingle that's hanging outside the pub. It's an old-fashioned painting, and in a beautiful cursive on a red background in gold letters, Nell of Old Dury. After shows, we all end up at this historic pub named after an actress from the mid-17th century. That's at 29 Catherine Street. Next, WA Cafe. I go here for Japanese cakes and coffee made with meticulous attention to detail. It's hard not to be a bit of a Japanophile when you're in the Royal Ballet. We have our biggest fan base in Japan, and it's the place we tour most consistently as a company. And you can get that at Instagram.com/ WA Cafe London. Our next contributor is Charlotte Mensah. She's a hairstylist, and she's in Portobello Road. Charlotte Minsa, who spent her childhood in Ghana, moved to Portobello Road in 1993 and immediately fell in love with the street's namesake, Market, particularly the music and fashion-focused vendors at the Ladbroke Grove end. I could always find some up-and-coming independent designer, like Preen or Oswald Boateng, she says. There was a young, fresh energy, and it wasn't too styled. That's where my love for the area came from. So, in 1999, when Minsa opened her salon, Hair Lounge, Portobello Road was a natural choice. Minsa now has celebrity clients. Janelle Monáe, Michael Coel, and Zadie Smith have all sat in her chair, but Hair Lounge somehow still feels like a local spot. People have literally met here having their hair done and then gone on holiday together because they've got on so well, Minsa says. She's a lovely woman, dark-skinned, long braids, very long braids and lots of them. She's wearing an off-the-shoulder red, bright red shirt, possibly a dress. We can only see her from the shoulders up. And she has gorgeous brown eyes that are lined with eyeliner around them, making them very distinctive. And so, continuing with her notes, found in vision. This vintage store sources beautiful, well-looked-after clothes, so even if they're 20 or 36 or 30 years old, they still look brand new. I recently bought some 1990s Patrick Cox wannabe loafers there. Honestly, I don't know how they find this stuff. There's a little sketch of these loafers. That was foundandvision.com. Hassan Morocco Fish. We all call Hassan the fish man. He makes whole grilled fish with Moroccan tomato sauce, rice, chips, and salad. It's all done outside in the market. That's why I like it. And that's on Goldman Road at Portobello Road. No phone. Honest John's Records. This place has been there for 40 years, and it's where I go for really old rare groove. I also pass People's Sound Records every day on my walk to work. It was run by a guy called Daddy Vigo, who was a good friend of Bob Marley. Vigo passed away, but it's run by his son now. I'm just so glad that these places are still there. Honest John's, and John is spelled J-O-N, .com. Or the other one is People's Sound Record Shop. Trailer Happiness. I always see people I know at this rum-focused bar. It's a big neighborhood staple with a subterranean vibe and multiple DJs on Friday nights. The owner, Sly Augustin, also makes a drink with gin and mint and flowers that I love. And that is it's a bar entitled Trailer Happiness. Next up is a woman named Cynthia Shanmugaligan, and she's a chef. And she is in the Borough Market. Before opening her first restaurant, Rambutan, in Borough Market this fall, Cynthia Shanmugaligan had a summer pop-up selling soft-serve ice cream with flavors influenced by her Sri Lankan heritage. Alfonso mango, cashew and jaggery, a kind of cane sugar, malted chocolate milk. She soon fell into the rhythms of the historic food market, which is nestled under the Victorian railway arches near London Bridge. Her parents arrived from Sri Lanka in the 1960s, and she grew up in Coventry in central England. The key things for my mum were fresh curry leaves, coconut milk, and tamarind, she says. Now that Rambutan, which serves Sri Lankan food cooked on charcoal, is up and running, Shanmugaligan tries to incorporate ingredients directly from other vendors in the market. And some of the places she names, she's a young woman of Sri Lankan descent, obviously, so she's dark-skinned, just not a light brown skin, long shoulder-length brown straight hair, a big hoop earring in one ear, and she's kind of looking off to the side with very intense eyes and a sort of a wry smile on her face, wearing a green shirt, kind of an emerald green, with a gold necklace. The first thing she mentions is Berenjak, B-E-R-E-N-J-A-K. The Iranian chef Kian Samyani does one of the most amazing hummuses I've ever had, made with black chickpeas and walnuts. Unbelievably rich, dark, and delicious. And that's Berenjak, London.com. Black chickpeas. Elliott's. With a small menu that changes regularly, lots of natural and biodynamic wines and wood-fired breads and pizzas, this is one of the best places to eat in the whole market. Elliott's, that's a double L, Elliott's.London. Furness Fish. At this old family-run fish stall, it's always a spectacle. There are octopuses, sea urchins, and slightly miserable-looking gilt-head breams on display. There's an oyster bar, too. And the photograph here is of a plastic container, and it says on it, Morecambe potted shrimps with butter. And it's got the Furness label on it. And next to that looks to be a slice of pizza. I'm not sure what's on it. It looks like, well, I suppose it's some of the potted shrimp. That's what it is, but the very small popcorn shrimp. Next we have Neil's Yard Dairy. Championing traditional British ways of making cheese, the staff at Neil's always explain the techniques to you and give you something to taste. The Stichelton Blue is my favorite, plus Kirkham's Lancashire, full of umami. And that's Neil's Yard Dairy. Neil is N-E-A-L-S. Next up, we have Ryan Chettiyawardena. He's a bartender, and he's in the Hoxton Street area, H-O-X-T-O-N. He looks to be a man, perhaps in his 30s. He's wearing a patterned shirt. He has pink kind of glasses that sort of blend right into his face, a two-day growth. He's brown-skinned with dark hair that's cut quite close to his head, and he's smiling at us. When Ryan Chettiyawardena opened his first establishment, White Lion, spelled L-Y-A-N, on Hoxton Street in 2013, it felt like a bar from the future. All the drinks came pre-mixed and pre-chilled to avoid waste and give bartenders time to focus on the customers. It worked. Jay-Z and Beyoncé dropped by, and Bjork performed impromptu karaoke. For years, the core crowd was made up of the fashion, music, and LGBTQ communities. White Lion closed in 2017, but Chettiyawardena has since launched Lioness and the Seed Library in London, Super Lion in Amsterdam, and Silver Lion in Washington, D.C. Still, low-key Hoxton Street remains the center of his world. Hoxton is very close to the heart of things, but it feels like it has skipped a lot of the gentrification of Shoreditch and Dalston, he says. It retains a lot of the old character of the East End, and it's also been a key street in the alternative musical, cultural, and culinary scenes. Next, the Clove Club. And there's a photograph here is of Clove Club's take on Parton Brie, a Scottish crab soup. I'm not sure what to say about this. I think this is the crab shell perched on top of this dish. It's red and very bumpy and prickly. Maybe it'll tell us. I often pop into this place on Old Street, which does inventive and modern British food. When it opened a decade ago, it totally rejuvenated the London dining scene, and it's a lovely example of what Hoxton embodies. The owner is also very dear friends. The Clove Club, tasting menus from 172. I think this is one of those gastronomic marvels of that foam stuff that I've seen on cooking shows in the center of this bowl, and then with some rice and other food items in it, perhaps some shrimp, or crab, of course, and then they've perched that crab shell on there just for fun, I guess. Next is F. Cook, C-O-O-K-E. At one of the oldest pie and mash shops in London, you order steak and ale pie, mashed potatoes, and, quote, liquor, which is actually a parsley sauce. They advertise jellied eels, too. I've just never mustered up the courage to actually order them. And we have the shop shown here, Pie and Mash. F. Cook, it's all kind of an emerald green exterior here with windows, large windows that run the length of the shop, all the way down from the signage on the second story all the way down to the street, so you can peer in and see everything they've got to offer. And in big letters in gold, F. Cook. The Macbeth. The XX, James Blake, and Florence and the Machine all played early gigs at this legendary venue. It's also been a sanctuary for the LGBTQ community and is still very much a youth culture party spot. TheMacbeth.co.uk. The Museum of the Home. Right by Hoxton Station, this is London's best small museum. It's a series of recreated living rooms that is a wonderful lens on UK culture. And then we've got a little blurb here about Welsh rarebit. What is it? A dish in which a sauce of beer, cheese, mustard, and sometimes an egg is poured over toast, then broiled. Where is it from? Rarebit's origins can be found in the Welsh dish Cos Pobi, which means toasted cheese, and it's now found everywhere. Where could I find it? After hiking in Brecon Beacons National Park, stop at the International Welsh Rarebit Center to tuck into either a classic rarebit or one of the cafe's riffs on the original. And some claim that eating a rarebit before bed can cause nightmares. I can't imagine how toasted cheese could do such a thing. I love toasted cheese. All right, Tales of the Riverbank is next on a watery journey through Brecon Beacons National Park in South Wales. Nina Ruggiero learns to let fate take the wheel. And the photograph, oh my, I want to go there. This is one of Country Craft narrowboats, barges, gliding down the Monmouthshire and Brecon Canal in Wales. And I've seen these on British shows. They're long and skinny, so they can slip through narrow canals, and they are very shallow. This one is painted red. It looks to be mahogany on the bottom. Very shiny, reflecting the sun. I almost thought it was blue, and maybe there is a part of the bow that's painted blue. But there are windows all along, as if you were sitting on a train. And then, as I said, the above is painted red, but lots of windows, and sort of shaped like a submarine. It's passed right through under a stone bridge, an arched stone bridge, greenery all around. The water looks very brown, not anything I'd want to jump in and swim in, but I can imagine the silence as these boats glide along. So let's see if that's actually the case. Slower, my partner Alex yelled from the footpath beside the canal I was barreling down. His warm Welsh accent and deliberate tone almost masked the panic in his voice. In response, I promptly pushed the wrong lever forward and ran our 40-foot-long narrow boat full speed into the metal underhang of the drawbridge Alex had just cranked open. Luckily, full speed on this vessel is about 4 miles per hour. Still, metal hitting metal produced a resounding bang, stopping a small crowd of passers-by in their tracks. Really slowly, Alex repeated. For our third-day canal trip through Brecon Beacons National Park in South Wales, we had rented the boat from Country Craft Narrowboats in the village of Llangeidr. I don't know how to speak Welsh, but it's Llangeidr. Llangeidr. Alex grew up nearby and often fished and camped in the area with his family. Our boat, Country Girl, had a double bed with plaid bedding, a full kitchen, a lounge and dining area, a bathroom with a shower, and a deck big enough for two camping chairs, where we would sit with our morning coffees while ducks paddled along beside us. I do see that little deck now. Our 20-mile round trip took us along the Monmouthshire and Brecon Canal from Llangeidr to the town of Brecon and back. We floated past rural villages, sheep-filled pastures, and the red sandstone peaks of the Brecon Beacons, the mountain range for which the park is named. We followed a map of canal-side pubs, mooring up overnight so we could easily retire to our boat after dinner for a game of cards or go straight to sleep in our cozy floating home. After a wet, windy day of lifting and lowering canal locks and maneuvering out of mud banks, no place embodies a Quitch, C-W-T-C-H. I think they need to buy a vowel. The Welsh word for a cuddle, hug, or small safe space. Quite like a warm pub. We often pulled up, hair drenched, clothes dirty, damp dog in tow, and were welcomed with open arms. After stopping at the Royal Oak, that has entrees from 14 to 27, in the village of Penselly, it wasn't long before we received a call that our boat had come loose. Alex ran out into the rain to fetch it. sitting by the fire with a glass of Brecon gin, a Welsh spirit that's distilled with water from the national park, helped take the edge off. Naturally, we celebrated our halfway point in Brecon with to-go gins with all the trimmings, rosemary sprigs, grapefruit slices, and black peppercorns from Hop Inn Beer and Gin House. Small plate, $7 to $9. Later that evening, we docked near Three Horseshoes Inn, a gastropub in Grosford, and feasted on braised leeks, pork belly, and Cornish monkfish. Those entrees are $17 to $30. Our days were spent in blissful solitude. For hours at a time, we soaked in the sights and sounds of the park, sometimes stopping for a stroll or a picnic. When the rain came, as it did each day, we would jump into survival mode, grabbing our waterproof gear and shouting directions, our voices lost in the wind as we haphazardly guided our ship to safety. Somewhere within that contrast of peace and adrenaline, I gained a deeper understanding of the fondness with which Alex always speaks of his childhood to the Brecon Beacons. His deep-rooted positivity and enthusiasm for the everyday, which felt so refreshingly foreign to me when I first met him, suddenly made sense. If the Welsh didn't learn to dance in the rain, they wouldn't have much time to dance at all. And here we have some logistics here, canal cruising in Wales. How to book. The six barges offered by Country Craft Narrowboats have all the comforts of home. Available March through October, countrycraftnarrowboats.com. Three-night rentals from $949. Farther afield. To explore Wales more deeply, contact Nicola Butler. She's a TNL A-list advisor who plans trips throughout the country, including hidden gems like the Pembrokeshire coast. And that's nicola@noteworthy.co.uk. And we're still working on the UK as the destination of the year, and this one's entitled Art and Industry. It's by Charlotte Higgins. From textile town to hotbed of music, Manchester has had a rich and at times tumultuous history. Now the northern English metropolis is establishing a new identity as a global cultural hub. And here we have a photograph to begin of the Manchester skyline. It looks like most other skylines in the distance, but in the front we have some very old buildings and a bridge that actually, I'm not sure if that's a, it looks like a freight train on the bridge, but it looks permanently there, and maybe we'll hear a little bit about that. It looks like a depot alongside that. Have you been to the John Rylands Library yet? Asked our server at breakfast. It's my absolute favorite place in the city. My partner and I were eating in a magnificent early 20th century dome trading hall, now the dining room of Manchester's Stock Exchange Hotel, with doubles from room 60. We had just emerged from our bedroom, snow-white sheets, pillows piled high as small mountain ranges, sepia photos of the former trading hall in full tilt. Parentheses, the hotel is co-owned by the former Manchester United soccer star, Gary Neville. Since we were fortifying ourselves with a breakfast of Staffordshire oat cakes with mushrooms, a regional delicacy, our server was right to infer that we were preparing for a day of energetic cultural tourism. Happily, given the passion with which the words were spoken, my partner and I were able to reassure her. The library had been our first stop on a weekend in this great northern English city that was built on the 19th century textile trade and is now polishing a well-deserved reputation for culture in all its forms, from football, of course, to music, theater, and the visual arts. The John Rylands Research Institute and Library was built in 1900 by Enriqueta Rylands, the widow of the industrialist for which it was named, in what was then an overcrowded and slum-ridden part of the city. It's a neo-Gothic palace of learning, full of literary treasures, including the earliest surviving papyrus fragment of the Gospels, dating from around AD 200. An elaborate stone staircase leads to the double-height reading room, where visitors can study under the Art Nouveau light fixtures designed to recall the cotton flowers from which Rylands and this city made their fortune. When we went, the library was hosting two free exhibitions, one of editions of Dante's Divine Comedy, the other about the city's late 20th century pop cultural heritage, including Ian Curtis's handwritten lyrics for Joy Division's Transmission, and early accounts of the Situationist influenced design for the Hacienda Club, which became the center of the dance music scene in the late 1980s. Somehow, Dante and Curtis seemed like the perfect mix in a city where high art and popular culture gleefully, sometimes chaotically, mingle. And there is a photograph here of this reading room. As it said, it is double-storied, and it's just magnificent. It looks like a cathedral. The second story has balcony all around overlooking the story below. Arches all along the balcony, arches beneath it, and books upon books on shelves, but also a great deal of carving on each one of these arches, that kind of Gothic style decorative at the top of each arch, and lots of statuary between each arch as well. It's also beautifully lit. There's a clear story on top that lets natural light in, but the lights themselves, the Art Nouveau lights that they talked about, have a golden glow about them, so there's nothing garish about this place at all. It's very warm and inviting. In the 19th century, Manchester was one of the wealthiest cities in the world, a fact reflected in an urban landscape that combines Victorian grandeur with vast, repurposed former cotton mills and frenetic modern development. The city is still grappling with the fact that the raw cotton that made it rich was grown by enslaved people in the Americas. In the fascinating Science and Industry Museum, I saw the machines that revolutionized spinning and weaving in northwestern England from the late 18th century onward. But not much yet on the human misery on which that revolution was built. It's a story that will be told more completely in the coming years, when a large-scale renovation of the museum reaches its fruition, the director, Sally MacDonald, told me. The exploitation of labor was also domestic. It's no coincidence that Friedrich Engels' 1845, The Condition of the Working Class in England, with its harrowing description of slum conditions, was written in this city. A statue of Engels, who worked for his family's thread company for two decades, can be seen outside Home, an arts center with a mixed program of performance, visual art, and cinema. This rough, concrete tribute to communist ideals once stood in a village square in eastern Ukraine. It was removed by the villagers in 2015, when Soviet monuments were outlawed. The British artist Phil Collins transported it to Manchester in 2017, still bearing the colors of the Ukrainian flag with which it had been daubed during protests, as an artwork that speaks powerfully to the issue of who gets commemorated and where. At Home, we sampled part of the British Art Show, a quinquennial survey of work from the UK. Home is one of many cultural institutions that have flourished under a politically stable city government that, since the 1990s, has identified the arts as a means of providing Manchester with economic and social benefit in the post-industrial era. Dave Mutry, Home's director, filled me in on this history over a delicious lunch at Refuge, small plate $6 to $18, which is housed in a magnificent 19th century insurance company office. A devastating IRA bombing of the city center in 1996, he explained, became part of the catalyst for energetic cultural regeneration. Later that year, the Bridgewater Hall opened, providing a venue for Manchester's two excellent symphony orchestras, the Halle and the BBC Philharmonic. Over the intervening years, many institutions were renewed, not least the Whitworth, a university museum set amid tree-filled gardens that has an impressive collection of historic art and design, and also mounts contemporary art exhibitions. Parentheses, we particularly enjoyed a commission by Suzanne Lacey, an American who filmed residents of a Lancashire town sharing singing traditions in a disused textile mill. But it is perhaps the biennial Manchester International Festival that has become especially important, both to the city's standing internationally and to the aspirations of fellow cultural institutions. Since its founding in 2007, MIF has commissioned work from a range of artists, from Steve McQueen to Punch Drunk and Marina Abramović. Its raison d'etre is to put on a kind of work that London wouldn't or couldn't. Manchester's cultural leaders are a collaborative bunch. Mutry and I were lunching with John McGrath, the artistic director of MIF, and Esme Ward, director of the Manchester Museum. She had just shown me around its galleries, which will reopen in February 2023 after a thorough revamp with an exhibition of the museum's glamorous Egyptian collection. The next big step for Manchester will be the opening of a new venue for MIF, The Factory, named in honor of Manchester's Factory Records, the label of Joy Division and New Order. On a hard hat tour of the site, McGrath showed me the huge L-shaped space, which will be able to accommodate 5,000 for a standing gig or 1,600 for a theater performance. Opening in time for MIF's next edition in summer 2023, the factory will also offer year-round programming, plus bars and an outdoor space leading down to the banks of the River Irwell. No other place in the UK, he argues, will have anything like this building. It's all part of making Manchester, he hopes, a net importer of artists and a net exporter of arts. And senior editor, Tim LaTurner, says one of our favorite things, TV bingers will recognize the Prince's Head in the mellowed enclave of Richmond as the pub on Ted Lasso. It's a great place to people watch and have yet another pint. And let's look at some of the photographs. Here's Esme Ward, the director of the Manchester Museum, in its Living Worlds galleries, and she's standing up on a balcony that overlooks, I think, two lower balconies, a balcony and then the first floor. And we can't see any of the exhibitions, but she's wearing a long black dress and a long decorative scarf there that looks maybe batiked. It's very colorful. She has reddish hair, and she's looking off and smiling, presumably at one of the exhibits. And overhead, this looks like it could be like a train station ceiling. It's a lot of glass overhead, and yet another what looks to be a balcony. But this one is all enclosed with an iron fence, so I'm not sure if it's accessible to the public. Here's some gardens at Whitworth Gallery, and there's a lot of white flowers. I'm not sure what they are, but white and pink, just profusely covering the ground, some trees in the background, and then a two-story building, and on the bottom story it says Playtime. I don't know if it's a structure where people go in and play, but above it looks like a restaurant, and there's a gentleman standing there at a table and chairs, presumably cleaning the table, because I don't see anyone sitting there. The restaurant at the Holmes Art Center is shown here as well, all encased in glass. There isn't a piece of wood or metal other than to support the glass anywhere. And the tables are all just very simple wooden tables, and it looks like metal chairs on a polished concrete floor. So very kind of industrial looking, which fits with this industrial part of the town. Here's that statue of Engels they talked about that was brought here by Phil Collins. And it is heavy in concrete. It has a very Soviet look about it. But it was Ukrainian, as we know. And we still see some of that blue and yellow painted on there. And that concludes our article by Charlotte Higgins. The photographs were by Emily Ben-Dixon. Now for our last article in this UK Destination of the Year section, and it's entitled High Drama. On the trail of two Tudor women, a headstrong queen and an enterprising countess, Nina Kaplan explores England's Peak District, where the rugged landscape becomes a portal to the past. These photographs are by William Craig Moyes. And so we begin. Across the street from the great curve of golden sandstone that is Buxton Crescent, against a backdrop of tiered gardens rising toward a war monument, sits a small stone fountain. Not the kind that cascades, but the kind you drink from. St. Anne's Well is so understated, so overshadowed by the Crescent's astonishing 18th-century facade, that I'd spent 24 hours in the town before I noticed it, and that was only because people kept approaching it to fill their containers. The contrasting size and impact of these two stone structures is misleading, because the Crescent, which reopened as the 81-room Hotel Buxton Crescent in October 2020 after a mammoth $80 million restoration, would not be there without St. Anne's Well, part of the natural thermal springs bubbling unseen beneath visitors' feet. Rainwater spends 5,000 years trickling through subterranean heat, then emerges at 80 degrees with, apparently, marvelous rejuvenating properties. I thought I had come to Buxton, 25 miles southeast of Manchester, in the county of Derbyshire, to travel 5 centuries back in time, not 5 millennia. I have long been fascinated by a number of Tudor women who spent time there, including an imprisoned queen and a powerful countess. But it turns out that this health-giving water, renowned since at least Roman times, trickles through everything. England would not be England without it. Buxton is almost entirely encircled by the Peak District, the United Kingdom's first national park and one of its loveliest. The area is well named. The roads tilt around high hills, their patchwork of green dotted with lambs in late spring. When Mary, Queen of Scots, was placed in the custody of the Earl of Shrewsbury in 1569, she was just 26 and loved to temporarily escape her imprisonment on his property by riding over these wild lands. Over the course of 18 years, as Mary's cousin and jailer, Queen Elizabeth I, remained implacable and her hopes of freedom faded, she became ever more sickly, and there's a plaque on the wall of Buxton's Old Hall Hotel commemorating her many visits to, quote, take the waters. The town really became fashionable when William Cavendish, 5th Duke of Devonshire, cannily built the Crescent, a complex of hotels, in the 1780s, a deliberate attempt to take advantage of the emerging wage for spas. Parentheses, the Crescent's perfect Georgian arc is an imitation of Bath's Royal Crescent, which was finished the decade before. Early wellness had a lot in common with the modern kind. The natural mineral baths on one end of Buxton Crescent, the new baths, now a shopping mall, on the other, and the elegant marble pump room opposite all demonstrate that beautiful surroundings were considered as important for curing the sick as water that, in winter, is as warm as new milk and, quote, performs many miracles, as the topographer William Worcester, visiting in 1460, had it. Today, the hotel spa is a fabulous underground grotto with 3 saunas, a cave made from blocks of salt, excellent for clearing the airways apparently, and 2 indoor pools, plus a 3rd partly open air on the roof. 1 pool contains actual Buxton thermal water, heated above its natural tepidity, where guests can soak beneath an elegant decorative canopy of colored glass. I like to think the blue is the water and the green is the Derbyshire hills, said the attendant, looking up. Glass in Derbyshire has an importance all its own, as I quickly discovered. A short walk through the pretty pavilion gardens brought me and my husband, Craig, to the double-story glass pavilion café. Both were designed by Joseph Paxton, head gardener to the 6th Duke of Devonshire. At Chatsworth House, the Devonshire's family seat 16 miles east, Paxton created a conservatory that was at the time the largest glass building in the world and the prototype for London's Crystal Palace. That achievement was hard for me to appreciate, probably jaded by giant glass museums and skyscrapers, until I went to Hardwick Hall, which stands 30 miles to the east and was built by the Duke's ancestor, Elizabeth of Hardwick. Elizabeth, known as Bess, was the original reason I had wanted to visit Derbyshire. Born in the 1520s to a small landowner who died before she was 1 year old, Bess worked her way up, via 4 marriages and numerous clever investments, to become Countess of Shrewsbury, after the Queen, the most powerful woman in England. Immensely intelligent, she turned every setback to her advantage in an era when women, barely educated with few legal rights, weren't supposed to display any brains at all. Bess was both adaptable and tough, and in this she resembled her native land. The Peak District is part porous limestone, part unyielding sandstone, and those warm springs are forced to the surface at the point where the two meet. Before seeking her out, I went walking on that sandstone, partly because it is outstandingly beautiful, but also because it's a route back into England's past. That warm, bubbling water didn't just soothe royal bones. Since it never froze, it made this the ideal place to build the earliest water-powered factories. And so, a century after my Tudor women died, Mary beheaded for treason in 1587, Bess of natural causes in 1608 at the then impressive age of 81, men began constructing the Derwent Valley Mills that helped to power the Industrial Revolution. Derby is the southern gateway to the valley, which runs north through the park. The city's mills are now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The Derby Silk Mill, built in 1721 by Thomas and John Loam, is widely regarded as the world's first factory. Beside the River Derwent, the mill still looms, a gargantuan brick structure now topped and flanked by glass additions. John Loam went to Italy to steal the silkmaker's secrets, early industrial espionage, and increased production to millions of yards of thread a day. The factory was always a tourist destination. Daniel Defoe visited, as did Benjamin Franklin. In 2021, the mill, which had been gutted by fire in 1910, reopened as the Museum of Making, a place that combines the newfangled interactive tourism and the old-fashioned, actually building things, in a manner reminiscent of those early industrial pioneers, if without the exploitative working conditions. On our visit, we saw a giant, quote, grasshopper beam, steam engine from the 1850s, so-called because the mechanism resembles the insect's hind leg, and an early 20th century loom with spools of cotton still attached. A brass microscope had belonged to Charles Darwin's grandfather, and a modern artwork was inspired by thread. The concept of making was everywhere, in the many on-site workshops, the full-size airplane engine built by Derby-based Rolls-Royce, suspended from the ceiling, and in the mill itself, rejuvenated with the help of more than 1,000 volunteers. Five people cleaned 11,000 bricks, Hannah Fox, Derby Museum's Director of Projects and Programs, told me. In an era of declining industry, it was as exhilarating to witness this creativity as it was to gaze down at the powerful river that started it all. Nothing in Derbyshire is terribly far from anything else. Derby sits a mere 30 miles from Buxton. So I hatched a crazy plan to cycle along the Monsal Trail, a converted railway line just east of Buxton, to Chatsworth, then follow the roads north to the village of Eyam, E-Y-A-M, and picturesque Hathersage. The novelist Charlotte Bronte stayed in Hathersage in 1845 and drew inspiration from Mr. Rochester's house in Jane Eyre, from the slightly sinister mansion, North Lees Hall, that still stands. Yes, it would take more than 4 hours, not including stops for sightseeing and lunch, but it used to take Bess of Hardwick a week to reach London. Three things deterred me. The first was Craig's expression. It seemed possible that he, like Mr. Rochester, was considering locking me in an attic. The second was the sneaking suspicion that a place called the Peak District might not prove ideal for a fair-weather cyclist. The third was the tip that I should not leave Derbyshire without eating lunch at the restaurant of Fisher's Baslow Hall Hotel. Sheepishly, I downsized to just the Monsal Trail, an easy 8.5-mile bike route. As I biked along, I found that human productivity collided with nature's industry. Steep banks of moss, fuchsia orchids, and cascades of pink-white hawthorn blossoms alternated with chilly tunnels bored through the hills for the trains. We pedaled across Monsal Dale, a limestone gorge, via a 300-foot viaduct, and paused to look down at Cressbrook, another early factory, a giant white presence in the next valley. The ride was lovely and flat, and it did not interfere with lunch. We ate extremely well in Derbyshire, cream teas at the Devonshire Arm pubs, there are three within easy reach of Chatsworth, Bakewell's famous sponge pudding in the ludicrously beautiful village of Little Longstone, a few miles north of Bakewell, modern tapas at the Cow, a low-beamed pub with rooms in Dalbury, near Derby, even a superb goat curry at Stella's Kitchen, a charming Afro-Caribbean restaurant just a mile away from Eyam. The village itself was poignant with its plaintive plaques sprouting among the cottage gardens' tumbling flowers that tell the story of an outbreak of plague in 1665 and of the Reverend Mompesson's heroic decision to quarantine his parish to protect everyone else. A third of the inhabitants died. There is still a hollowed-out stone where parishioners left money dipped in vinegar, the 17th-century hand sanitizer, in exchange for food. Still, none of our good eating prepared me for Fisher's Baslow Hall. Within this elegant stone manor house, in a sunlit bower where painted birds and plants crept up the wallpaper, each exquisitely presented dish was paired with an unusual yet perfect wine by sommelier Matt Davison. I had known that this sort of lunch would be incompatible with a full day of cycling. I had not realized how the afternoon would flow past in a hazy, delectable stream until we were too late to visit Chatsworth, despite its being just 3 miles away. Bess of Hardwick, I feel, would not have approved. But then, even with all her wealth, I doubt she ever ate a meal like that one. The modern world does have a few things to recommend it. And folks, there's a little bit left of this article, and of course the pictures to describe, but we'll have to leave it off there for today. So, until next time, thanks for joining Mind's Eye Radio. Take care.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.